Okay, hi everybody. Good evening. It's 8:30, so I think I'm going to start. I was told that Rabbi Kelman is not going to be able to make it tonight, so I should just start my shiur. So, for those who don't know me, my name is Nechama Price. I am a professor at Stern College for Women. I am the director of GPATS, the graduate program in Advanced Talmud Studies for Women, or Talmud and Tanakh Studies for Women. I'm a Yoetzer Halacha, and I am honored to give you a shiur tonight. I'm going to share a screen so that you could see the source sheet. I also put in the chat the source sheet, so if you want to download it yourself, and probably Rabbi Kelman sent it out as well. So I believe you should be able to see the source sheet right now. Somebody who has their video on, can I get a thumbs up? Anyone who has their video on? And it's moving, Susan, as I go up and down.
Yes, it's
Thank you.
fine. It's
Awesome.
fine.
Okay. Perfect. So let's begin. If everyone can go on mute, please. Awesome. Okay, so I wanted to give you a share tonight on this coming week's parsha that we are going to be reading in 2 days from now. As you all know, it's a double parsha, Matos Masei, and we are finishing Sefer Bamidbar. And therefore, based on the fact that we are finishing Sefer Bamidbar, I thought it would make a lot of sense to discuss closure or endings, endings to books, endings in general. And I think if we're honest, we all like a good ending. We all like a good ending in a book that we're reading, in a movie that we're watching, even in a TV show. We like a good ending. We like one that brings us closure, or we like one that makes us happy, or one that makes us even cry at the end. But we like when we have that type of closure and we expect closure. Nobody likes a to be continued or, something that leaves open so many questions at the end of a story. And therefore it does make sense that when you're learning Torah, the books of the Torah also have closure. They all have a beginning and they all have an end to the Sefer that we read. Just think for a moment in terms of the other Sfarim, right? So Sefer Breishit. So we start from the creation of the world. Adam HaRishon is born. We move through the time of the Avot till we get to Yaakov. And Yaakov is, of course, the one who's going to create the nation of Israel, right? His 12 sons, they go down to Egypt. And in Egypt is where we become a nation. And therefore, it makes sense that the book of Bereishit ends with all of the family of Yaakov, Shivim, Nefesh, the 70 souls, go down to Mitzrayim, where they're going to create the nation. We then start Shemot. And Shemot, we pick up where we left off in Egypt. We receive the Torah. We've left Egypt, obviously. We receive the Torah. And we are on our way in the desert and we build the Mishkan. And in so many chapters, there's details of how we build the Mishkan and what we're supposed to do and how everything is supposed to look. And therefore, it's beautiful that the end of Sefer Shemot is that we finish building the Mishkan. We put everything inside of it. And the Shechina, God Himself, comes down and dwells in the Mishkan. It's the most beautiful ending of the book of Shemot. Vayikra is a book of laws. Devarim also has a sad ending, but certainly a closure of an ending, which is we are now done traveling in the desert. Moshe spends the entire book of Devarim giving the longest goodbye speech, ever. And finally, it is time for us to go into Eretz Yisrael. And Moshe says goodbye and goes up on the mountain and he dies. There's closure. There's an ending to all of the different books that we have of the Torah. So you'd think, right? What we're going to read, the ending to Bamidbar, the last story of our 40 years in the desert. We've been there for a really long time. It's got to be an awesome story. It's got to be a story where all the Jewish people recognize Hashem and recognize the value of Eretz Yisrael. And it's got to be that last story has to be so exciting. And therefore, when we get, and we will see it in 2 days, to the end of Matos Masei, we are shocked. We are shocked because if you look at source number one with me, the very last story that we read is about the fact that we have five women, the Benot Slavchai, who get married, Libnei Dodehem Lenashim, who marry their cousins. That is the last story of Sefer Bamidbar. And the reason why that seems to be, I would think, so shocking is number one, we really don't have women so much in the book of Bamidbar. So it's kind of shocking that they are the final story, other than Miriam, who speaks Lashon Hara and gets Betzaras, but other than that, women are pretty absent in the book of Bamidbar. But number two, the fact that they marry their cousins, I mean, like, what's the big deal? You know, maybe they had a shidduch crisis also there in the Midbar, but I don't think that's the last story of Sefer Bamidbar, is five sisters got married. I really don't see that as being, you know, the final story and the epitome of all, you know, the ending of everything of Sefer Bamidbar. It just seems really strange. So what I'd like to do today is to try to figure out and give a number of obviously different answers. What is so significant about this final story that we're going to find at the end of Bamidbar? And the first approach is to say, maybe I got it all wrong. Maybe I got it all wrong. The Benot Tzlafchot are not the focus of the end of Bamidbar at all, but rather that's one detail in the end of a bigger story. And the bigger story is actually about part of the tribe of Menashe. It's really not about Benot Tzlafchot at all. So let's just take us back so we make sure that we understand, you know, what's going on here. It happens to be this final story is a part two of a story that began in Parshas Pinchas, which is why it even makes it weirder that it's the ending of Bamidbar, because it should have been after part one. So it sounds like Moshe purposely cut the ending of the story of Parshas Pinchas, put it as the final story of Bamidbar. So why is it there? There's got to be significance. But what do I mean it's a part two? So part one that we read this past Shabbos is that Benot Tzlafchot have a situation where their father has died. They don't have any brothers, and therefore they are not going to be able to, their father is not going to be able to inherit land, meaning no one from the family is going to carry on his name and inherit land on his behalf. And they think that that's not fair. So they come to Moshe and they complain to Moshe, and Moshe makes a decision that if there are no brothers, the daughters therefore can inherit the land. And that's the end of the part one of the story. Benot Tzlafchot are told that they could inherit the land that was supposed to be given to their father. Great. Now we go on and other things happen. And as you'll read in this week's parsha, lots of other stories. And then we finally, in Perek Lamed Vav, again, the last story of Bamidbar, we get to part two. What is part two? Menashe wakes up and says, we have a problem. What is the problem? If you look with me at source number two now, you'll see what happens with Menashe. So Menashe comes, and again, it lists, right, for the children of Gilad, who's the sons of Machir, of Menashe, but tracing them all the way back to Yosef. Vayedabru lifnei Moshe, and they come before Moshe and all of the Nesiim and the heads of the Jewish people. It's a very serious matter, and I'm going to read where I bold. Adonitzi vahashem latete ta'aretz benachala bergora. Right? You gave us command number one. You said to us there was going to be a lottery, which there was, and you were going to give out the nachala, the portions of land, based on what God decided we were supposed to have. Okay, fine. And that's how the land's supposed to be given out to Bnei Israel. But now we have a problem, because now you commanded something else. Second command, here we go, where I bolted again. But now you're saying that the nachala that was supposed to go to our relative Tzlafchot is now going to go to his daughters. Well, we have a problem. It's not fair. What's going to happen? Well, let me tell you what's going to happen, and I'll just give some background before I translate the pasuk. We all know that when it comes to passing down Judaism, it goes through the mom. If the mom is Jewish, the child is Jewish. However, when it comes to tribes, it goes through the father. So if the father's from Shevet Reuven, the child is going to be from Shevet Reuven. So here's the problem. They say, what happens if these women who now inherit land decide to marry somebody from a different Shevet, right? We're Menashe. Let's say Benot Tzlafchot marries somebody from Reuven. And now what's going to happen? They're going to have a child, and that child will technically be a child, a son, who will be from Reuven, because his father's from Reuven. And now what's going to happen? That child, when the mom dies, is going to inherit the land from his mother. And now our piece of land that was in Menashe's territory is going to be transferred over to a different tribe. In my example, it's Reuven if they marry someone from Reuven. And therefore, Nachalateni Gareah, we're going to lose out on our land. Our land is going to get smaller because a portion of our land is going to go to a different tribe. And maybe this is the piece of the story that's important as the final story of Bamidbar. And my first reaction to this story was, well, what am I supposed to learn from it, right? Because this is the story of who Menashe is supposed to marry. It's all based on the fact that Menashe complains. And my first reaction to the story was pretty negative. I mean, it sounds a little bit greedy. It sounds a little bit selfish. Here, finally, Moshe says women can own land, and Menashe's got to come in and be like, that's not fair, no way, and wants to take away their right to inherit. And it also reminds me of a story that we're going to actually look a little bit deeper into in a few minutes, which is also in this week's Parsha, but Parsha's Matos, which is the story of Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe, who want to live on the other side of the land because it's beautiful and it's big, and they want so much land for their animals to graze. And therefore, maybe it's part of a pattern of Menashe wanting more and more land, right? They want lands on the other side, not just the land they're given inside. So here's Menashe saying, I just want more and more and more. I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose any little piece of land. And then I thought maybe I could expand it a little bit, because if you look back at source number two, for some reason it needed to trace these people back, not just to Menashe, but to Yosef, B'nai Yosef, which I underlined here for you. And then I was thinking maybe this is a pattern in Yosef itself, meaning Yosef would be Ephraim and Menashe, not just Menashe. What do I mean by that? If you look at source number three with me, you see that there's another story that sounds kind of similar, which again is a negative story. Yehoshua gives out the land as Moshe commanded based on the Goral and the lottery to B'nai Yosef. And B'nai Yosef comes to complain to Yehoshua. And if you look at source number three, where I bolded, Madua natatali nachal ad goral achad, v'chevel achad, v'ani amrav ad asher ad kober hani Hashem, God has blessed us, we're a huge tribe, you didn't give us enough land. And Yehoshua's answer is not, oh yeah, I made a mistake, I'm so sorry. Yehoshua's answer, if you look at Pasuk Yitzayin, again, where I bolded, to Beit Yosef, using the same language, to Ephraim and to Menashe, again, emphasizing this is a Yosef trait, Lemur amrav. What talking about? I gave you enough. I didn't give you one goral. I gave you what you're supposed to get. Go conquer your land. There's still some of the Canaanim living in your land. You have plenty of land. Stop complaining. And therefore, maybe there's a pattern here of Yosef complaining when it comes to land because they always want more and more. And therefore, they're complaining when Bnei Tzlafchan might get a piece of the land. They're complaining when Yehoshua gives them a piece of the land. They're always seeming to complain. And if I wanted to continue this pattern, if you look at source number four, which I labeled Gidon and Yiftach, Gidon and Yiftach are both judges who come from the tribe of Menashe. And I believe very strongly that traits run through the tribes. And I happen to have a book, if anybody wants to buy it, called Tribal Blueprints, which traces the different traits of the different tribes based on their stories in Bereishit throughout all of Tanakh. Exactly what I'm doing with you right now is what the entire thesis of the book is all about, but with all the tribes. But if you look at source number four with me, you see that it's a very similar story. In the time of Gidon, Gidon is the first one. He's the judge, and he's the judge from Menashe. And he has a victory, and he is able to, you know, get us freed from the rule of Midian. And after that comes along, and this is after the victory is over, but Yomri Lav Ish Ephraim, Ephraim comes over to kind of scream at him. Mahadavar Hazah Sita Lanya Lubilti Karot Lanya, why don't you call us into the battlefield? Why are they mad they didn't get called into the battlefield? Again, Ephraim being from Yosef, because they wanted some of the booty. They wanted the spoils of the war. And here we have Menashe and Ephraim complaining and kind of, you know, getting into this fight over who deserves all the spoils of the war. Well, Menashe really was the greater fighter, and therefore he's deserving it. And Ephraim's like, well, you should have invited me so I could have gotten some too. And we see that pattern continue, because if you look by Yiftach, we have the exact same thing. Yiftach again is a judge, is one of our leaders from Menashe. And once he's able to free us from Ammon, comes along Ish Ephraim. Ephraim comes to scream at him, Madua Barti Lechem Ibnei Ammon V'lanu. Why didn't you call us to come fight in the battle? They almost burned down his house. They're so mad. So here again, you see this kind of desire for more, desire for money, desire for land that you find within the tribe of Yosef. And therefore, maybe that's what this final story is about. Menashe getting upset that they're going to lose some land. They just want more and more. Now, if this is what the story is about, it's kind of depressing, right? I said we like endings. Sometimes it's a bad ending, but this would be a very bad ending, because think about the structure of Sefer Bamidbar, right? The first 10 chapters of Sefer Bamidbar, we're getting ready to go into Eretz Yisrael. We're so excited. We're lining up. We got our encampments. We're ready to go. Vayihi ben Soa Aron. We're about to go in. And then, as we all know, Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11, Vayihi ha'am kimitonin, and we start to complain, and then we complain some more, and complain some more, and then it's the Meraglim, the spy story, and now all of a sudden, we're stuck wandering the desert for 40 years. And now, we're back on track. We're in the 40th year. We're ready to go in, And what do we have? The final story? We complain again, right? It's a depressing ending to Bar Midbar. No matter what, we seem to complain. And to make it even worse, if I look at the end of Sefer Bereishit and all the issues we have at the end of Sefer Bereishit, it's all surrounding the tribe of Yosef. It's Yosef who's the favorite, Yosef who the brothers hate, Yosef who the brothers are jealous of, Yosef, therefore, who's in conflict with his brothers, with complaining and fighting. And therefore, once again, Yosef is the center of attention of the end of Bar Midbar, leaving us on a quite a low of a complaint at the end of our 40 years. Now, I'm a very positive person, so I really don't like that reading whatsoever. Though, of course, I have to suggest, because that certainly is a way to look at that story. But I would much prefer to look at it in a much more positive way. So I look at the story again, focusing again on Menashe. We're going to come to Benos Lafchad in a second. And I think about their complaint. What's their complaint? We might lose a little bit of the land. Yeah, that could be greediness, but that also could be a love of the land. You gave us a nachala. You gave us a portion. We want every little piece of it. We don't want any of it to be given away. We want to own all of it. And to some extent, if you think about it, it's the opposite of the Meraglim, who say, we don't want this land. We want to turn around and go back to Mitzrayim. It's the opposite of Reuven and Gad, who say, we want to live on the other side, even if that means, right, we're going to get a bigger piece of land. So we're rejecting the land inside of Israel. Here, I want it. I want every last piece. And how do I know, or what's a good proof that this is a positive story as opposed to the other two that I just mentioned? Looking at Moshe's reaction. If you think about it, when the Meraglim complain, we have a very bad reaction. Moshe yells at us, God punishes us. When Reuben and God ask to live on the other side, Moshe yells at them, right? That's his immediate reaction. Here, look with me at source number 5. Moshe's reaction to Menashe is not to critique them. It's not even to, you know, be annoyed at them, but rather, Cain, Mata, B'nai Yosef, Dobrim. They are right. They're right. And what they're saying, they are right. And then he goes on to explain why. And that's Pasuk Zion where I bolded. Ki ish b'nachalat mata avotav yidbaku b'nei Yisrael. You're supposed to be in the nachala that you were given. Everyone, there's an ideal of each shevet being in its own nachala. And just to really bring out that point, I gave you this very beautiful Rav Hirsch, which is right in front of you. I'm going to read it to you. Rav Hirsch writes, for every tribe with all its members, I primarily to be attached to the province allotted to it. Every part of the land is primarily to be kept as much as possible, stamped with the special tendency of the tribe to which it is assigned. And every tribe is to keep the specialty of that tribe as the mode of life of its members as much as possible without exception, which means that every tribe, there was a reason why God gave them that piece of land. And therefore, the ideal is for that tribe to own that land. And that's all the Menashe is saying. We want to keep the land that was given to us. We love the land of Israel. We appreciate it. And therefore, we want every last drop. Now, you may say to me, well, that doesn't really work with the other story that you mentioned a minute ago, which I said to you I was going to come back to, which is the story found in Parshas Matos, also this week's Parsha, where Reuven, Gad, and half of Menashe asked to be on the other side of the land. Well, if Menashe loves the land so much, why does he want to live on the other side? So there's two different answers that one could give. One is, you're right, half of Menashe rejected the land and half of Menashe loved the land. So first we have the story of the half of Menashe that rejected it, wants to live on the other side. And then we end the Bamidbar with the story of the half that loved the land, representing Am Yisrael, who loves the land and wants to live on the inside. And maybe that's a possibility why the story is moved to the end, so it's after the story of Reuben and Gad, to demonstrate that half the tribe of Menashe, representing the rest of Am Yisrael, loves the land. But I want to point out something very important to you. If you look at source number 6 with me, I gave you one specific pasuk, and it's something that I want you to pay attention to when we read this perek in this week's Parsha, which is the story of Reuven Gad is in Perek Lamed Bet, chapter 32 of Bamidbar. But the first time you hear about Menashe is this pasuk, 33 psukim in, pasuk Lamed Gimel. That is the first time Menashe is mentioned in the entire story when Moshe is giving out the land. And it says, Vayetein lahem Moshe lifnei Gad ulifnei Reuven ulachatzi shevet Menashe. Which means the entire story where they ask for the land, they negotiate with Moshe for the land, it never says Menashe. It only says Reuven and Gad. Sometimes it says Reuven and Gad, sometimes it says Gad and Reuven, but it never says Menashe. And the question is, why? Where was Menashe this entire time? And there are two very different answers that are given. Answer number 1, which I gave you represented here by the Ibn Ezra, is Lo hizkira atah chatzi shevet Menashe, bavur hayot chatzi shevet. Because they're only a half a Chevette. So, like, they were there. They were there the whole time. But, like, we didn't mention them because they're only half a tribe. But when we're giving out the land, we need to know that there was also this other half a tribe. But they were really there the entire time. Or you have the Ramban, which I gave you right afterwards here in source number 7, where the Ramban says also they were there, but says the Ramban differently than Ibn Ezra, they only joined in at the end. They weren't there the whole time. They weren't part of the negotiations. They weren't part of the back and forth. They joined in at the end. Look at the Ramban where I bold it. Aval kasher chalak ha'aretz l'shnei hashvatim, ra'asha ya'aretz gedola yoter min haru'i lahem. Moshe's giving out the land to Reuven and Gad, and they realize, oh my gosh, it's a really big piece of land that is being given sichon and oh, got a really big piece of land. Bibikesh, so Moshe asks, Misha yirtzeh litzachel imahem, who else wants to inherit with them? It's too big for just those two tribes. But you're on the Shem, Menashe, Hashir, Tzuba. So then Menashe's like, oh, we volunteer. Sure, we'll come. Now, in both of these answers, though, you could still get the feel of Menashe rejecting the land of Israel and wanting to live on the other side, fitting the first theory that half of Menashe reject the land of Israel and half of Menashe don't. But there's a second theory. And the second theory, I think, is a much stronger theory. I happen to prefer it tremendously, but I think that it helps us with our story, which is Menashe did not want to live on the other side of the Yarden. They did not. And that's why they're not in the beginning of the story. They don't ask Moshe to live on the other side. They don't negotiate because they don't want to live there. When do they show up? When Moshe decides to give them land. It's not their idea that they should live on the other side. It's Moshe's. Moshe says, if Reuven and Gad are going to live on the other side, Menashe, I need half of you to live there. The question is why? And I want to give you three different answers as to why that might be true, three very different approaches. If you look at the Chizkuni, which is source number 8 right in front of you on the source sheet, and again, if the source sheet's not moving the way it should, please let me know. Source number 8. Chizkuni writes exactly that. B'nei Menashe lo sha'alu lahem nachala be'eretz Sichon ve'Og. They did not want to live in the land of Sichon and Og. Rak b'nei Reuven ve'Gad sha'alu. Only Reuven and Gad wanted to live there. Ella, al yedei she'aviyam garam lahem l'shvatim shekaru bigdeihem b'matzeh gviyah, natzna lo nachlato b'shnei chalakim b'shnei evrei ha'Yarden. It was a punishment to the tribe of Menashe because of something Yosef himself did. Yosef took the goblet and put it in the bag of Binyamin, and when the brothers found that Binyamin had the goblet, they tore their clothes. Yosef is punished for doing that to his brothers, and therefore God deems Menashe, the one to get the punishment, which is you're going to be torn in half to live on the two sides of the Yarden. It was not something that Menashe wanted. It was something Moshe did to them, according to the Chazkuni, to bring about the punishment to Yosef. Okay. Abarbanel, however, gives a very different answer, which I think is very interesting. And Abarbanel says as follows. See, there's an extra bet there. Okay, Abarbanel says as follows. Same thing. Read where I bolded. Ki Moshe chavruah mehem achar kach. Moshe is the one who did it, but for a very different reason. Amnam mipnei shaita eres gedola me'od v'hem hayu am me'at b'tocha chiberi mehem Moshe Rabbeinu alav hashalom b'nachla hi chatzishev Menashe hi hayta eretz hahi kamo chamishit eretz Kanan. Right? He's like, it's so big. What's the issue of the land being so big? Well, Reuven and Gad can't defend themselves. Reuven and Gad are going to be lost in this land by themselves. Skip to where I bolded. Meaning, Moshe says, you have a special job. You have to go there to protect Reuven and Gad and to help them to build up the cities. Because I need somebody there to do that with them. Because if not, they're going to be in trouble living on the other side of the Yarden. Now, I love this idea of the Abarbanel, but I want to add to it because so many years ago, and I give credit to who I remember hearing this theory from. It's by someone by the name of Rabbi Tzvi Grumet, who used to be a Rebbe here in Teaneck, where I live, and now is in Israel teaching in Eretz HaTzvi. And he gave over the following theory, which again could be it's somebody else's theory that he was quoting, but I know it from him, so I'm saying it in his name. That it's very possible that Moshe Rabbeinu was very, very worried. He was worried that Reuven and Gad living on the other side of the Yarden was going to split from Am Yisrael, right? Over time, which is exactly what Yoshua was worried about, they're really going to pull away from Am Yisrael and not be part of Am Yisrael anymore. And therefore, what Moshe did was take a tribe that loved Israel and was very united, divided them in half, put them on one side of the Yarden and then on the other side of the Yarden, right next to each other, which is exactly what Menashe is. And therefore, they're going to hold them all together. Reuben and Gad's on the other side. We don't want them to disappear. So Menashe is the glue that holds the Jews on this side of the Jordan and this side of the Jordan together. It was a very special job given to them by Moshe. And which tribe is Moshe going to choose? The tribe that loves Eretz Yisrael. Well, how do I know which tribe loves Eretz Yisrael? That's our story. Menashe, who doesn't want to lose even one little piece of land, and therefore we see the love that Menashe has for Eretz Yisrael. Now, if this is the story, this is a much better story, and it actually explains to me something else. Try to look at this chart that I have in front of you and make some sense of this chart as you're looking at it. But what I gave to you is the countings. We know we have two different countings in Bamidbar, right? One in the beginning of the Bamidbar, which is when we first come into Eretz, when we first come into the Midbar, right after Egypt. And then in the 40th year, right, we have our second counting to see what are the numbers of the tribes. And what I gave it to you is a chart with both, with the columns of the two numbers. And then I gave you the difference, meaning which tribes went down in numbers, those are negatives, and which tribes went up in number by the time we were ready to enter into Eretz Israel. And I bolded two because I think it's very significant, right? What do we see here? Shimon is the one that went down the most. Negative. It's in the negative of 37,000, right? Went down 37,000 from the first year in the Midbar to the 40th. And therefore, it makes sense why so many of the Mefarshim assume Shimon was part of all the different sins in the Midbar. They were part of Egal. They were for sure part of Baal Peor, right? Because they were punished by so many of them dying. And therefore, it would make sense that if I look for whose numbers went up the most, by far, it's Menashe. Menashe went up 20,000, which the only other one that went up that much or is Binyamin, who went up 10,000, like 20,000. It's like so much compared to everyone else. And therefore, one could clearly see they were not involved in all of those different sins that we want to leave. We don't want to go to Eretz Israel. We want to turn around. That wasn't Menashe. And that's why Menashe's numbers went up. And therefore, it makes sense. We want to end the Sefer with this beautiful story of Menashe, the tribe that loves Eretz Israel, to finish out our book. It's a beautiful ending. Again, we're ready to go in the beginning of Bamidbar. We complain. We don't want to go in. And we end with this beautiful story of a tribe that so much loves Eretz Yisrael and wants the land so much they don't even want to lose a little bit of a drop, to kind of signify for us the new attitude of Am Yisrael, right? We're not the Meraglim anymore. We're not saying let's turn around. We're excited to go in. And that's the finale of Bamidbar. However, it is very hard for me to say that the ending of Bamidbar is about Menashe, because there is such a focus on the Benot Tzlafchad. So I'd like to return to another theory, which is to focus now on Benot Tzlafchad as the end of Sefer Bamidbar. And the reason why I find it very, very difficult to say that it's not really focusing on Benot Tzlafchad is the amount of time we hear their names. Now, we all know that to get your name mentioned in the Torah, you got to be important. Get your name mentioned in the Torah more than once, you're really important. Well, look how many times Benot Tzlafchad get written down in the Torah, starting from last week's Parsha. If you look at source number 10 with me, Bamidbar Chaf Vav, that's last week's Parsha, and that's what we're counting the men. We're counting the men in terms of inheriting land, in terms of the army, and in that list, there are very few women. There are three groups of women, to be exact. Who are they? So look at the list. The first one is Benot Tzlafchad, and there's all their names, Mahla, Noah, Chagla, Milka, right? All of them out. We have Sarach Bat Asher, which is a shir unto itself, why she likes to show up all over the place. And then, of course, we have Yocheved and Miriam, and that makes sense. They're very important women. Now, Benot Tzlafchad show up again. That's in last week's Parsha again in Bamidbar Chaf Zayin. That's the story where they asked Moshe if they could inherit land because their father has died. But again, Ela Shmo Benotav, these are their names, and all five names are listed. And again, that's very unusual for the Torah to really emphasize people's names. But here we go again, because in our Parsha, we're now in Bamidbar Lamed Vav, which is the next Pasuk that I'm pointing at. Here it is again, when they marry their cousins, Mahla, Tirza, Chagla, Milka, Noah. All of them again listed the Benot Tzlafchad. And guess what? That's not the end of their story. We have the part one in last week's Parsha, part two in this week's Parsha, and then we have a part three in Sefer Yoshua. In Sefer Yoshua, which I gave you here in Perek Yud Zayin, they come to Yoshua to say, remember, we were told we could inherit land, please give us our land. And there their names are again, Ela Shmo Benotav, Mahla, Noah, Chagla, Milka, Tirza. It's crazy. There they are again. That's time number four. But then I realized, because I'm actually writing a course right now in Divrei Hayamim, which is probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, but found in Divrei Yamin, amongst a list of old men, once again, except for Sarah Panasher and Miriam, ironically, here they are again, Batiyena Lislafchad Banot. Five times. Five times in Tanakh Banot Slafchad are mentioned, including this very ending of our Parsha. And therefore, I really need to say that it's got to be something that I'm supposed to learn about them that is the finale of Bamidbar. What is it? Now, if you take a step back about their story, and again, we're going to now put together part one from last week and part two, because it does go together. There is a very incredible parallel between the story from last week's Parsha and the story of Pesach Sheni, which I gave you here in source number 11. The story of Pesach Sheni, which comes up also in Bamidbar, is a group of people who come to Moshe and say, we miss Pesach, right? Pesach Rishon, can we have a duo, right? A do-over. And here comes the concept of Pesach Sheni. And what's interesting for both of these stories is that we didn't need them. We didn't need these stories whatsoever. We could have had one pasuk that said, and there is a law, if a man dies and has no sons, women, their daughters can inherit, right? And we could have had one pasuk that says, if you miss Pesach Rishon, right, you get a second chance the month later with Pesach Sheni. But instead we have a story, and in both of them, the stories are very similar, which I was trying to demonstrate for you here in my chart. If you look in both stories, they approach Moshe, right? And if you look at the language, Vayikrevu lifnei Moshe lifnei Aaron, Vatamod lifnei Moshe lifnei Elazar Kohen. So they're not just approaching Moshe, but they're approaching the Kohen Gadol of the time, right? Aaron is already dead by the story of Benot Slafchad, so they're approaching his son Elazar. They both use the same language in their complaint. Lama yigara, or lama nigara. Why should we lose out? We didn't do anything wrong. So why should we lose out? And then Moshe doesn't know the answer. So Moshe has to go ask God, which is the third row. And then when Moshe does get the answer from God and gives them the answer of this new law, the language is really the same. God speaks to Moshe and says, Daber al b'nei Yisrael emor, meaning don't just say to them what happened. This is a law for everyone. And then uses the words ishki. So when you have a certain situation, this is going to be the result. Very similar language between the two. Now, in the second row, I said it wasn't their fault. Why should we lose out? Well, if you look closely at the story of Benot Slafchad, that's exactly what they say. Source number 12, they say, our father died. Ki bechad omet upanim lo hayulo. He wasn't part of Korach. Like, he did something wrong on his own. That's why he died. It's not our fault. And he didn't have any sons. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to inherit. If you look at the story of Pesach Sheni, at least through the eyes of the Gemara in source 13, it wasn't the fault of the people who missed Pesach Rishon that they couldn't celebrate Pesach, but rather it's because, as the Gemara in Sukkah tells us, they were Tamei Meit, right? They were Tamei Meit. They were dealing with dead bodies. Pshat, of course, could be that, you know, people are dying in the desert and they were dealing with those dead bodies. But if you look at the Gemara a little bit closer, a few suggestions are given. One suggestion is, Nosei Aronos Shel Yosef Hayu. They were the people carrying Yosef. Yosef had asked, right, made us swear that we'll take his bones from the land of Egypt to the land of Eretz Yisrael. So there were people who were carrying his bones. So now they can't celebrate Pesach because they're Tamei. Or second answer, it's Mishael and Elzaphan, who are the nephews of Aaron, who carry the body of Nadav and Avihu when they die in Chanukas HaMishkan, right? So they had to carry the body, right? Or the last approach is they were dealing with Meit Mitzvah, right? They were dealing with a dead body, and therefore it's not their fault. So we have very parallel stories with Pesach Sheni and with Benot Slafchad, and the same question, which is, why did I need the story? Why couldn't we just have one pasuk that just taught us the halacha? And what I think the answer is, very strongly, is that the important part of the story isn't just the halacha that comes out at the end, because then we would have just had one pasuk, but rather it's the fact they had to ask. These are people who wanted something. They wanted to be part of something. We want to celebrate Pesach. We want to inherit land in Israel, right? We want something that's righteous. And they had to have the bravery to get up and to ask for it. Not so simple to go to Moshe Rabbeinu and to the Kohen Gadol and to ask for something, but they had to ask. And that's part of the story, celebrating the bravery to ask. And the reason why I believe that has to be what this story really is about is because of source 14, which I gave you here again, which is the part three of the story. The part three of the story is they do it again. In the time of Yeshua, they go to Elazar HaKohen again, and to Yeshua, and to the Nisim again, and say, remember that Moshe said we get to inherit land? Could you please give it to us. It's about the ask. It's about saying, I'm supposed to have something. I want something. Can you please give it to me? And the reason why I really believe strongly that this is such a positive story is because in Sefer Yehoshua, it comes in the context of two other stories that we know, two other groups of people that come to Yehoshua with the same thing. Moshe told us we could have land. Could you please give it to us? The first one, I gave it to you here in Source 15, which is Yehuda. Yehuda comes to Yehoshua and says, remember that Moshe said that Kalev gets to inherit a very specific land in Hebron because of what he did in the Meraglim story? Could you please give it to Kalev? And Yehoshua says, sure, I'll give it to Kalev. And then after that, we have our story of Binos Chofrad. Remember Moshe said we were supposed to inherit land? Sure, says Yehoshua, you can have your land. And then I gave you the third story, which is in Yehoshua Chaf Aleph, which is Levi comes to Yehoshua and says, remember Moshe said we get cities inside the other tribes' land so that we can have some land to live on? Sure, says Yehoshua. Here, Levi, here you get the land. So clearly here we see this is positive, right? Yehuda is positive. Levi is positive, coming to ask for something that they know that they have been promised. But the parallel is even stronger because if you think about Yehuda's request, it's about Kalev, who's the one person who said, we can do it. We can conquer Eretz Yisrael. We love the land. We should go. Alo na'aleh, we can do this. And therefore showing Binos Slavchat has that same attitude. We love this land. We want to be here. And Levi, of course, who, by the way, also is given those cities in this week's Parsha, right? Just like Binos Slavchat stories in this week's Parsha. But they're people who don't get to inherit land, just like women who don't get to inherit land, but they're told they get specific cities, and here they come to ask for them. So too, Binot Slavchad, who are the exception, women who can inherit land, and they're asking for the land. And therefore, in my mind, I think there really is no doubt the story of Binot Slavchad is about their love of the land. And it's not just me who thinks that way, Baruch Hashem, but it's Chazal as well. If you look at Source 16, there's this beautiful midrash which is captured in Rashi that I'm going to read again where I bold. Elo lomar lecha Yosef chibeb et ha'aretz ne'amar v'alita metatzmotai. Yosef loved the land of Israel, which is why he made us promise that we would bring his bones to the land of Israel. So too, binotav chivavu et ha'aretz. His daughters, the girls that come from Yosef, will love the land. Shene'emar tana lanu achuzah. And that's, of course, the language of Binot Slavchad. So just like Yosef loved the land, so too Binot Slavchad. And I think it's even more beautiful, as the Malbim is saying, Source 17. But what was the sin that Slavchad did wrong? Says the Malbim, Slavchad hayam and hamrim nitzna rosh v'nashuva Mitzrayim. Their father was one of the people who said, we want to go back to Mitzrayim. Wow. Melameid sitkot binotav shalolam du'vimasa. Right? His daughters didn't learn from him. They want the opposite. They want to go in. They want to inherit. They're fixing the mistake of their father. It's a beautiful, beautiful story. Now, there is a second possibility of what their intentions were, love of the land, but I think there's something else that's going on here that makes their story even greater. If you look at Source 18 with me, in terms of the language of what they actually say, yes, they say, we want land, but they also say, our father has died. Look at Pasuk Dalet. Lama yigara shame avinu bitoch mishpachto. Why should we lose out on the name of our father? They are doing this to honor their father and to honor his name. There's something about carrying on the name of their father. There's no sons to carry on the father's name. And when they marry somebody else, they don't carry on, their children don't carry on their father's name. They want to carry on their father's name. There's something very beautiful about that idea that they want to do that to honor their father. And it reminds me of two other stories that I gave you here. Actually, I think two other stories, I'm sorry, that I gave you here in Source 19. One of them being Tamar, which is a kind of sketchy story, but certainly one could see that Tamar, who ends up seducing Yehuda, is doing it because she wants to live on the name of her first husband, which would be Er. If you look at Achtav HaKabbalah, which I'll read very quickly, Ki masha astahi haya b'das yirat shamayim v'lo l'tavas gufanim. Don't think that she was doing it for her own sexual pleasure. She was doing it for the right reasons. What's that? Chashva machshevet mitzvah l'tiyabeh She wanted to continue the name of her husband who died, right? There's some beautiful value in continuing the name of someone who has passed away. Now, a non-controversial character like Tamar, well, or less controversial, I should say, is of course Rus. And Rus, we have the exact same theme, which I gave you here in source number 20, where both there's an emphasis of her marrying Boaz. Why? Lahakim Shem Hamet. And I gave it to you here twice. Lahakim Shem Hamet, Lahakim Shem Hamet. Her story is about making sure the name of her husband, which was Mahlon, continues on, right? Like she carries on his name now through this new child that is being born between her and Boaz. And in all three stories, source 21, we see clearly all three women are complimented for what they're doing. Source 21, right? Yehuda and Tamar, Sad Kami Meni, she's more righteous than me. When it comes to Rus, Boaz says, Brucha at la Hashem, blessed are you by God. And Moshe says to Benot Slavchad, Kain Benot Slavchad Dobrot, right? What they are saying is correct. A beautiful response of Moshe Rabbeinu. I gave you two different, beautiful ideas, one in Rav Hirsch, an earlier source, and one in a more modern source, Rav Elchanan Samet, that really captures this idea having to do with the Benot Slavchad. I'm going to read pieces of them with you. Rav Hirsch writes, however, in the case of Slavchad, the perpetuation of his name would come to an end, meaning the father, Slavchad, and the extraordinary opportunity for his perpetuation through the distribution of the land in the names of the family would be lost, and his name would be ceased to be remembered, meaning Rav Hirsch connects this story not just about getting land in Israel, but about carrying on the name of their father. If you see also, it's a beautiful thesis that's brought down by Rabbi Elchanan Samet, and I gave you the whole thing, and again, I put the source sheet in the chat, and they probably did send it out to you, so you can read the whole piece, but I'm going to read a little bit. When a man settles... Oh, I'll start from here. That is exactly the argument of the Slavchad daughters. Our father did leave descendants, five daughters, and those daughters are capable of continuing the familial continuity generation after generation by marrying and having children and grandchildren, all of whom will be direct descendants of Slavchad. They will not be without a portion. The husbands of the daughters of Slavchad will be the owners and of the land, and they will pass it on to their children. They were not motivated by their own rights, but something else entirely. The concern for the name, the memory, the continuity of their father, which will continue to exist through his daughters and grandchildren who will live on the land which he received from God. In several of the stories of Tanakh, which revolve around the need to establish a name, we find that women are at the front of the battle. So he also mentions Tamar and Rus and then says, the daughters of Slavchad join this distinguished gallery, struggling for the rights of the dead man and their family to have his name be established over his portion. And therefore what we see is two beautiful motivations that we could possibly put on Benot Slavchad as to why they were asking to inherit the land. One, love of the land. Two, continuing on their father's name. And now we return to this week's Parsha, the ending, the finale of Bamidbar, source 24. Let's look at that again. It's not just about them marrying their cousins. It's not a shidduch thing. Look what it is. The pasuk says as follows, and this is the ending of Bamidbar. I gave you till the very end of the sefer so you could see it. Kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe, Kain asu benot Slavchad. Benot Slavchad did what God commanded to Moshe, meaning they wanted to do what was right. They wanted to inherit the land in the right way because of the reasons that we just discussed, but they only wanted to do it if it was right and if it was the word of God of what they were supposed to do. Meaning, if God said, no, you can't inherit and Menashe is right, they would have walked away. They wanted to do what was right because they had the right motivations, and that's what's being told to us. But it's more than that. The next pasuk tells us they married their cousins. What does that have to do with anything? Well, if you look back, Moshe, remember, said to Menashe, you're right. So what was the solution? He said, anybody, therefore, that's female, that's going to inherit the land, they have to marry within their own tribe so that the tribe doesn't lose the land. That was a decree that Moshe, therefore, made after Menashe complains. But the Gemara in Source 25 in Baba Basra writes, that's very nice that Moshe made that decree, but that was after he gave Benot Slavchad permission to inherit the land. And therefore, Benot Slavchad, who truly nasei l'chol ha'shvatim? Technically, Benot Slavchad could marry whoever they wanted. They were told they could inherit land. All future women who inherit land have to marry within the tribe, but they didn't have to. They were given permission before. That's what the pasuk is telling us. They were doing it for such the right reasons. They said, even if it wasn't commanded of us that we have to, we're going to marry within the tribe because we want to do this for the right reason. We're not doing it for machloka. We're not doing it to make trouble. We're doing it because we think it's the right thing. We're doing it for the sake of our fathers, for our children. Of course, we're going to do what's right for our own tribe. And not only that, it's so incredibly beautiful that if we look closely at the pasuk, and the Malbim points it out, which I gave you over here in the Malbim, right, is that they not only marry within their tribe, but they marry their cousins. They marry within the family, like keeping the land as close as possible within their own family. If you look at Rav Hirsch, which I don't really have time for, you see that Rav Hirsch is exactly saying the same thing. They were incredible that they were doing what they weren't required to do, but they were doing all of this because they were doing it for the right reason, for the love of Israel, and because they wanted to carry on their father's name, and therefore they wanted to do it in the very right way. And therefore, Malbim points out, most of them married as close as possible within the family. Now, this is a very beautiful ending to the story because, again, it's celebrating a group of women who love Eretz Yisrael. It's a beautiful ending to the story. But what's fascinating is the Chazal broadens it. It's not just five girls who love Eretz Yisrael as the ending of the story, but they signify something. I gave you a bunch of sources here, and I'm keeping track of the time. Don't worry. The Gemara in Baba Basra, first of all, uses the story to this ending of the story to tell us, Benos Lachadar, Chachmaniot, Darshaniot, Sikaniot, right? They're incredible. They're wise and they're righteous and they're amazing. Why are they righteous? Once again, Sikaniot Hain, Shalonisu Elal, Lahogan Lahem, because they made sure that's the ending of Bamidbar, to marry in the right way, to marry in a way that would not cause a machloket, and would therefore, all of the whole story would end on a beautiful note. But not only that, the Gemara goes on to say that because they were so righteous, God made a miracle for them like Yocheved, and the Gemara explains they were already past the age of 40, and therefore they really should not have been able to have children. God miraculously allowed them to have children to be able to carry on the name of the father and the properties, you know, the nachala that they inherited to their children. It's like a miracle, like an imaho type story, right? Getting married at an older age and being able to become fertile once again. That's what the Gemara says about the Benot Slavchad. And so righteous we think of Benot Slavchad. I love when we have these midrashim that have like the top, you know, top five, top 10 people. Those are midrashim that counts the top 23 righteous women of the Torah. And you see right there in source 28, top 23 women, hey, Benot Slavchad, five Benot Slavchad are mentioned on this list. But as I mentioned, Chazal makes it much, much bigger. And what I mean by that is that they take this picture of Benot Slavchad loving the land of Israel, and they attribute it to all women of Israel. All women of the Jewish people love the land of Israel. I'm going to skip source 29 and move to the Kli Yakar in source 30. If you look at the Kli Yakar, I found it fascinating that there was like a thesis that was found in the Kli Yakar, and I gave it to you in three different places, where the Kli Yakar makes this bold approach that the Benot Slavchad, you know, are like are just examples of what women were like during the time of the Midbar. And if you look, I'll just point out little pieces in the Kli Yakar with you in source number 30, which is as follows, an idea which I'll then show you as fact. You know, the complaining that we want to go back to Mitzrayim and not go into the land of Israel, that wasn't the women. It was only the men. And therefore, the gzera to die in the Midbar was only for the men. Why? Because the women love the land. How do I know? Like, they're the ones we learned it from, that the women love the land, all because of the statement of Benot Slavchad. And again, of Ahanashim, Ayuk Sheirot, Vitznuot, the women were really so incredible. If you look at the Kli Yakar now, again, continuing along on the next parak, within the story of Benot Slavchad, it again goes on to say, it's the men who rejected the land, it's the women who loved the land, wanted the mitzvot, wanted to do challah, wanted to do the mitzvot tluyot ba'aretz, the mitzvot you could only do in the land of Israel. Look at the end. How do I know all the women love the land? Al benot slavchad shu sikoniot v'hayinu lefi shayu avim hatzdaka al kenem rutzna la'chuzah. It's all based on this model of the benot slavchad. But the Kli Yakar takes it even one step further, which we'll see Chazal does as well, which is not only did the women not do meraglim, not do the complaining, and therefore did not have to die in the desert, says the Kli Yakar, they didn't do chayta egel either. They were the ones who didn't want to give their jewelry, didn't want to be part. The Kli Yakar, this beautiful story of the women in the Midbar, who, by the way, I mentioned in the beginning, they're not in Sefer Bamidbar, but maybe there's an understanding why they're not in Sefer Bamidbar. Bamidbar is about those who complain, about those who sin, those who mess up. Well, the women are not mentioned because they're not doing any of that. They want to go into the land of Israel. They're not complaining and they're not part of the sinners. And this exact idea we find here in Source 31 in Bamidbar Rabbah by Chazal. If you look at the beginning, and I want to read you the end because it's so incredibly powerful. Oto hador hayu hanashim godro mash hanashim portzim. The women were doing what the men could not be able to do. What do I mean? Vahanashim lo nishtatfu imahem b'masa egel. The women were not part of egel. V'chim meraglim. They weren't part of meraglim. Skip to where I bolded. They weren't part of this idea at all. When God determined we all have to die in the desert, yeah, you're right. The only people who get to live is Kalev and Yoshua, but that's the men, not the women. Because the men didn't want to go into the land. The women wanted to inherit the land. This story is written here, the Benot Tzelafa story, to show us the love of the women for the land. It's actually amazing. This beautiful picture that Chazal is drawing from the story of Benot Tzelafchad, of the women who've been in the background of the entire story of Bamidbar, they are really the heroes of Bamidbar, loving the land and wanting to go into the land. And again, we already know this kind of story of the women being in the background, where the Gemara and Sota, we're probably very familiar with this midrash, where the Gemara and Sota tells us, "Beschar nashim sidkanios shayu bo tador negalu Yisrael Mitzrayim." We only came out of Mitzrayim because of the nashim sidkanios. So all of a sudden, we have this incredible picture of the women the entire time of that generation being in the background doing everything they're supposed to do. And even though I started by saying women are not really in Bamidbar, maybe they really are. Start the story of the Midbar not in Sefer Bamidbar, but when we start the story of coming out of Egypt. In the story where we start, very beginning, is Shifrem Puah, who saved the baby boys. Miriam, who's watching over Moshe. Yocheved, who nurses Moshe. We then have the Nashim Sidkanios that help us to get out of Mitzrayim. We have the women the whole time in the Midbar, loving the land and wanting to go in. And we conclude Sefer Bamidbar with Benot Tzelafchad, who demonstrate their love and desire for the land. The entire Bamidbar is truly celebrating the women of the Midbar, the women, the Jewish women of that generation. Now, you may say, I'm a female, so I'm biased in this type of reading, but it happens to be this exact picture is actually created, not the entire detail, but a picture similar to this in Source 33, Rabbi Michael Hatton on the VBM. If you look very quickly with me, he has this really beautiful read to our story. Again, I'm going to read where I bolded. He starts by talking about the idea of Benot Tzelafchad and says, but more importantly, indicative of the spirit of all the women of Israel, meaning Benot Tzelafchad are really all women. While the men of Israel fretted and feared the report of the spies and brought ruin upon themselves by rejecting the gift of the land, the women had remained steadfast, for they knew that God's word would be fulfilled. For 40 years, the women of Israel had patiently waited for the expiration of the decree pronounced in the aftermath of the sin of the spies. While not directly subject to its lethal impact, they had nevertheless suffered its harsh side effects, confined to the oblivion of the wilderness while all the men around them, the menfolk, perished. But during that time, they had never ceased to hope for better days. Continue where I bolded. With the land about to be divided up among the male offsprings of those ungrateful fathers, the daughters of Tzelafchad stepped forward, speaking not for themselves, but for all the women of Israel. What about us, they exclaimed. What about our faithfulness and trust? What about our love of the land? Shall our mother's 40 years of patience go unrewarded? And of course, God responds, right, by saying yes. While all around them there is despair and foreboding, weariness of the struggle, but uncertainty about how to proceed, the daughters of Tzelafchad provide us with hope. God's promise, though it may be delayed, and we may yet suffer setbacks for fearing to trust in him, will not go unfulfilled. One day the land will be apportioned amongst the people, and Israel shall settle it. A very beautiful read to the ending of Bamidbar, a beautiful ending celebrating the women who love the land of Israel. But I want to give you, in the last final minutes, one more approach. Why can't we combine the two? Why can't it be that the end of Bamidbar is celebrating the men who want the land of Israel, the women who want the land of Israel, Menashe representing the men. We don't want to lose even one drop of land. And Slavcha representing, Beno Slavcha representing the women. We want every piece of land. We want to be able to inherit. What an incredible ending to Bamidbar. If we're fighting again, because the Jews were always fighting, right? But we're fighting over how much we love the land and how much we want every piece of land. What an incredible way to end Sefer Bamidbar with a pshara that makes everybody happy. Menashe doesn't lose their land, but no, Slavka gets to inherit land, and we all live happily ever after at the end of Sefer Bamidbar. Why would I have such a theory? Well, look again at both of the stories, and this, of course, happens at the very end of Sefer Bamidbar. The story of Benot Slavchad and the story of Menashe. The wording is so parallel to tell us this is the same complaint. They're both doing the exact same thing. If you look at source 34 with me, Benot Slavchad is described as Ben Gilad, Ben Machir, Ben Menashe, Lemishpachot Menashe, Ben Yosef. Right? A whole description taking us all the way to Yosef. Well, now look at Menashe when they come. Bene Gilad, Ben Machir, Ben Menashe, Mishpachot Bene Yosef. It's the exact same language. Then both of them come and again speak to Moshe and the other leaders. And they both, and I'll be honest with you, look at the Menashe story. He even references back. Remember the story of Benot Slavchad. And both of them use the same language. Lama Yigara, Nachalatenu Yigarea. Why should we lose out? And look at Moshe's response to both. It's the exact same thing. Kain Benot Slavchad Dobrot. Cain Mata Bnei Yosef Dobrim, right? One's in feminine and one's in male. The same exact positive reaction from Moshe Rabbeinu, because he's saying, you're asking for the same thing. You're both saying you love the land and you want every last piece of land. You're right and you're right. So let's find a solution so that everybody can get what they want, which is they get to inherit the land of Israel. And therefore, if I go back to the beginning, what is the ending of Bamidbar? It's beautiful. We start out, we're ready to go into the land of Israel. We're ready. Vayehi ben Soar Arom Perek Yud. We complain. We don't want to go in. We don't want to go in. We're hungry, we're tired, we're thirsty, we don't want to go in, over and over and over again. 40 years later, the ending of Bamidbar is we're fighting for the land already. We're like so excited to go in. We're fighting over it before we even enter into the land. That's the excitement that we have, both the men and the women. Menashe representing the men, Beno Slavchad representing the women. It's the total undoing of the sin of the Meraglim. Now we want to go into Eretz Yisrael. It's the most perfect, most beautiful ending to the book of Bamidbar. And I do believe for us today, as I know all of us cannot stop for the last, 300 days. I cannot believe it. Watching the news and thinking about Israel, our hearts and our souls are in Israel. It doesn't matter where we are physically sitting. We are all, half of us, we're all in Israel. We are thinking about Israel all the time. And therefore, for this week's Parsha, for us to understand that the ending of Bamidbar is a celebration of the love of Israel and a celebration for all of us in our hope and our desire that we should all be able to live in the land of Israel in peace very, very soon, all of us together. I think it's the most beautiful ending to the Sefer and the most perfect finale to the story of Bamidbar. I thank you all very much for joining me. I'm going to stop the share and open the floor if there are any questions.
Beautiful share. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shani. I appreciate it. Good to see you.
I think it's very beautiful what you said. Moshe Rabbeinu unfortunately said, I'm not an Omein. I don't have the feminine characteristic. What was his punishment? He couldn't enter Eretz Israel.
Nice. Thank you. Nice. Good share. Thank you. Anyone else?
They are both sides, both of the tribe of Menashe and the daughters of Selofchat, agreed to abide by what Moshe said. And considering all the times in the book when everybody is fighting Moshe and they're basically blaspheming him and saying he has bad motives and stuff like that. Here you have two groups, each of which has a good, good reasoning, agreeing to, comply by what he says. And so finally we're all on a good page to go into the land.
I'm with you. It's just tragic that he dies at that point, but yes, I'm with you as well.
I'm bothered by all this. in a different way than I'm bothered by the tribe, precisely because of the tribalism of this, that the boundaries of Israel don't change, but my particular portion does. You know, when I speak to Israelis, they say, well, as long as Tel Aviv doesn't get hit by missiles, they don't care, the center, about the extremes to the north and the south. They care about their little nachala, whether it's Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. As long as that doesn't get hit, who cares about the north? So I'm troubled by this in a way. And I'm troubled, you know, there's a saying by a comedian. My analyst told me you were no good for me, so I changed analyst. If I wasn't looking at all the people you looked at and just saying, is this a good trait? I would say it isn't a good trait. We're celebrating it because it's there, not because independently we think it's a good trait. At least that's my take on it. I'm bothered by it.
So just to respond, I would not compare it to the Tel Aviv situation in any way. I think there's a difference between not caring about other tribes versus each tribe having its own identity. And there is no denying that throughout the Torah, each tribe is given an identity. We're given a nachala. We're not said free for all. Everyone go into Eretz Yisrael and live wherever we want. Yehuda lives in Yehuda. You know, Reuven lives in Reuven. That's the way it was set up. I mean, certainly you can have a taina against Hashem and the way he set it up. But I think that there's a very strong that God wanted each tribe to have its own land, its own leadership, and to care about each other. And that certainly is the theme of Shoftim, which is we stop caring about each other. And that's why we have problems, because every tribe is only caring about itself, which is what you're describing. And that is certainly critiqued in Torah, right? But by Sefer Shoftim, I think that's like the biggest critique of the entire book. But here we're not saying, I want my tribe land and I don't care about you, but it's every tribe has its own identity and therefore is given its own land and is entitled to its own land. But that doesn't mean it doesn't care and want to help its brother. It's exactly the opposite of what I was saying before, where Moshe puts Menashe on the other side to be a help to Reuben and Gad. I think part of the system here is not to not help each other. Shimon is inside the land of Yehuda. Levi is scattered amongst all the tribes. The way it's set up is so that ideally everyone should help each other, but also have their own identity. So 100%, just think about, you know, tzedakah. You care within your family first, then your community, and then you work outward. There's a system. So there's a system here in the way the tribes are set up. And that's certainly the way that the Torah sets it up.
But none of this would have changed if the Blatzlachad wouldn't have received anything. All that would have been true. And especially if their father hadn't sinned, whatever the sin was, we connect it to something by Midrash. If he hadn't sinned, they hadn't been married, they wouldn't have had kids, they wouldn't have inherited. That would have been the happier outcome, with the father not sinning. And they wouldn't have inherited.
I mean, we don't know, and I'm not sure what the connection is of that statement was to your other statement. We don't know that if the Benot Slavchad story didn't happen because our father didn't die, that this law would not have existed anyway through a different means, or Moshe would have said it. I mean,
but
the
if
law
they would remain unmarried, if they remained unmarried, if his the father wouldn't have died, he had no sons to inherit. He would have gotten something.
You're not hearing me. I'm saying, even if Slavchad had not died, and therefore this story had not taken place, I do believe that if it is correct that God wanted women to be able to inherit if they didn't have if their father didn't have sons, there would have been a pasuk in the Torah that would have taught us that. The Torah teaches it to us through the story of Benot Slavchad. But if it is a correct lesson and God wanted it to be so, it would have been so whether or not Slavchad sinned or not, or did or didn't have sons or not. That's just the means that the Torah taught this law. It's not that this is the only reason why this law occurred. But anyway, I'm happy to discuss with you offline if you'd like. I'd like to let our crowd go. It is way past time. Is there anyone else who wants to say something before we go?
Yes, I've never heard any Tel Avivian saying that all we want is our city. And who cares about anybody else? I don't know who he's talking to in Tel Aviv.
I don't either. I feel like everybody in Am Yisrael right now is caring about everyone else.
And I agree.
Think That's a beautiful way to end, just like I think B'nai Tzlachat and B'nai Menashe were looking out for the greatest effect for the Jewish nation and their love of Israel. So too, I think all of us together, B'yachad, we love each other and we hope for peace and safety for all of Am Yisrael wherever we live. So I wish you all a wonderful Shabbos and a very good night, everybody.
Amen. Shabbat shalom.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Beautiful share.
My pleasure. Thank you. Have a good night, everyone. Bye.